Gray Wolf Computer System has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, May 28th, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, on our program, Ken Milburn joins us for discussion about digital photography. During the second half of the show, I will welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give you that information, and again, when I invite you to participate in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Miles Elam, programmer and student of American literature, and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing communications manager for Transmeta. Sean and Miles, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Morning.
Morning, Lyle.
Geeks, before we get into our discussion about digital photography and with our guest, who will join us via phone shortly, let's cover what's been going on in the technical realm this week. Miles, I'll start with you.
A company called Dynamic Digital Depth is bringing out a DVD player that plays normal movies in 3D.
Wait a second. Really?
There was a story we did a little while back about the Sharp Actius R3 D3. It was a laptop that the screen was made in such a way that as long as you were sitting in front of the laptop at a certain distance, it showed up as 3D without glasses, without any, mm-hmm. Without the red blue glasses or polarizing glasses. And what this player is doing is taking that same technology and it analyzes parts of the movie itself to see whether things have a perspective going on. In other words, a small object is getting bigger and bigger and moving slightly. So it can artificially add a 3D element to it.
But you'd have to have a 3D screen.
Screen for it.
Neat. So, wow, that's fascinating. Thank you, Miles, for that. Sean?
Yeah, Toshiba has announced a prototype color 3.5-inch quarter video graphics array input display.
What's that?
The 3.5-inch screen meant for PDAs and the like. They call it a system on glass. And this screen allows you to capture images directly via sensors that are within the film transistor LCD of the screen itself. Pictures.
So an LCD that can receive pictures?
Yeah. So basically,
does it have to be powered off or in a different state? Or is it going to just be doing it while it's displaying?
I don't think this is a prototype.
Too much detail.
It's too much detail at this point. But basically, with this technology, if you had any device using this screen, you could actually lay it down on the catalog and capture images, read barcodes, recognize and authenticate fingerprints for security purposes.
So it's like a scanner.
Maybe have a map somewhere that you need to drive to, slap this down and capture it, that sort of thing.
Wow, that's a great idea to have a scanner in an LCD.
Yeah.
So it's just prototyping at this point.
Yeah, they're about to unveil the prototype. Yeah. And they're also unveiling a 3.46-inch QVGA organic light-emitting diode display.
Ooh, so it's going to be bright. What company?
This is Toshiba.
Great. Thank you very much, Sean. Miles.
Mac OS X has released 10.3.4.
I upgraded yesterday.
However, it still fails to fix a security hole in Mac OS X that was announced a little while ago.
The help file security hole? Where it launches help files through a web browser?
The protocol handler, yeah, that goes through WebCore.
Uh-huh.
I believe that's the same thing for the help file, yeah. And it basically comes down to when you put in http://, that's what's known as a protocol handler.
Right.
And this one, Mac OS X has the feature of you can plug in new protocol handlers. well, for help, this is one area where it's had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the big news, though, is that Apple has released a fix, and...
And it didn't fix it.
And it didn't fix... Well, it fixed it slightly. It fixed some problems, but people, researchers have gone back in and found it didn't fix the whole problem. So this is being seen as the biggest critical flaw that Apple has yet had.
For security.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming that they're working on it to fix the problem. The helpers in OS X are actually kind of convenient with being able to launch different things. But really, it's a convenience thing. The idea being that if you have this protocol, this operating system is going to know how to run it.
Right. Something that's written on the net is a way to put in a default handler, basically, so you can't put in new handlers, but then it reduces functionality for some other applications. So it's kind of like you can neuter your system for a short period of time while they work on the fix.
There is a great, if you're in OS X, any version, and you're interested in managing the helpers, like which application launches which, you can download a control panel plugin called More Internet. It's called More Internet. One word, I think, in a Google search with OS X in there as well will probably get you the application. It's a free thing. And it's kind of nice because you can change how things run. Thank you, Miles, for that update. Sean, we'll skip over to you, sir.
Yeah, SanDisk, a maker of removable flash memory cards, has unveiled some new memory cards. They have a new 1 gigabyte card. Other companies have that, too.
Sure.
They have a 256 meg card that incorporates Wi-Fi connectivity into the same SD card.
An SD card that has Wi-Fi capability?
With 256 megabytes of memory, yes, combined.
Wow, that's interesting.
So it uses direct sequence spread spectrum wireless LAN technology. Mm-hmm. And they're targeting cell phone handset makers like Motorola, Sony Ericsson, and the like.
So you can plug this into your cell phone and then transfer data to it via wireless from your laptop.
Correct. Example. And you'd have an additional 256 megabytes of memory.
That's easily accessible.
Right.
Very neat. Thank you much, Miles, for that. Sean, for that.
Yes.
And then we'll switch over to Miles.
Renewable energy from algae. One of the big pushes...
That sounds so hippie-esque. I love it. Go on.
Yes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Contrast the nuclear show we had a little while back.
Sure.
So with regards to biofuels, one of the big pushes has been to have general crops to like corn... to grow for alcohol, for example, or ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been problems with getting this on a large scale because you need to grow food and then there's the amount of cars that we have. Well, a group has found a way to do or to harvest algae in areas that are mostly salt water or near waste streams. This is potentially big news because a waste stream, for example, would be the downstream area from a farm,
mm-hmm.
all the either fertilizers and the like that go off and usually pollute streams, and suddenly it becomes this ecological disaster, where this allows for growing the algae onto basically these areas that are normally just wasteful.
So you grow all this algae, then what do you do with it?
Basically, in an area about 10,000 square miles, which seems like a lot, but I'm talking about square miles. You're able to. We could actually create enough biofuel. In other words, a biodiesel,
mm-hmm.
Something oil-based, something that you don't have to convert many cars to be able to run on this and reduce dependence on foreign oil.
Cool.
One of the stats that I was seeing actually was normal plants. When you're talking about going for alcohol or ethanol conversion, you're going to get maybe 1-2% energy efficiency mm-hmm. from the sun. Sun giving a certain amount of energy, it's going to convert it to fuel. And sugarcane, being the exception, gives you almost 8% efficiency.
Wow.
But this is actually trumping all of those. And just for the fact that you don't have to put all the energy into harvesting and the like, it's very easy to handle. You're ending up with something that's extremely efficient, much more efficient, and easier to do on a large scale, it different.
Do you know the percentage rate on the algae?
I think what it has actually is that algae is
easier to process.
It's 4% efficient, but you don't have to go
plant
through as
and
many
break down the material and all that.
Right.
Processing.
You don't have to do as much in terms of fertilization, right. In terms of harvesting.
Cool, Miles. Thank you very much for the story. Sean, you're typing away on your HP handheld. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, it's my HP Giornata. I'm trying to
access
the wireless here. For some reason, our security here is
tight. That's good.
I must be. I don't know.
Next item.
So this company out of Austria, Vienna-based, Altova, has developed a free tool for XML. And I guess it is quite popular because 500,000 users have downloaded it and are using it. What this tool allows you to do is to look at XML code as if you were looking at it as a spreadsheet or a word processing document. And the software is called Authentic. And Altova makes back-end software for IT people who manage, you know, large companies. And they're hoping that this tool will provide people with the ability to create XML content for those people in the back who they sell their software to.
Nice. Yeah, it's actually been a big problem with the GeekSpeak website.
Correct.
Right? It all runs on FXML, and the editing of the XML is actually quite a bit of a challenge. So maybe we should take a look at this. Miles, have you seen it?
No. Then again, I'm still skeptical, seeing so many that they said, like, yeah, we're going to make it look like a word processor that smoked some crack.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. But this one, in a spreadsheet form, makes a lot more sense. I mean, to some
yeah,
degree.
And we've seen it before.
For data-oriented stuff. Yeah,
when you save it as XML, of course, the XML is not DocBook.
Well, this one probably edits your XML document, loads it in.
So it should be interesting to see.
In any case, we're talking totally off of that topic. Miles, got another story for us today? Are you good?
I'm good.
You want to do another one?
Well, I could do another
Please
one.
Please do. Please do. You have a beautiful voice.
Okay. To go off of the algae story, we have a story about Professor James Lovelock, who is the creator of the Gaia hypothesis. This was back in 1969, talking about the Earth as an organism,
right.
Something that an interrelated system, very complex. He has come, and he has been a leader in the green movement. He has publicly come out and said that the Greens need to go toward nuclear power. Someone who was a leader in the movement has now moved in this direction. This is, in fact, he used very strong words in this. Saying that the threat of global warming, well, he was associating it with the threat of the Nazis in 1938. Don't know if that's really a fair comparison. They're apples and oranges here. But at the same time, he was saying that we don't have any other energy sources that
was was his inference that the left was kind of ignoring the Nazi problem, just like they're ignoring global warming?
Well, the idea is that it's a major problem, but you're kind of just ignoring it until it gets really out of hand.
Mm-hmm. So he's suggesting going to nuclear to stop the global warming issues that we have.
Right. So basically, it's a way to displace using natural gas, oil, and
fascinating.
Coal.
Had another subject on the issue of nuclear energy. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam. Thank you, gentlemen, for the news this morning. The migration from traditional photography to full digital workflow is one of the most profound changes in creating images since first photographs in the 1820s. Ken Milburn is a digital photographer in San Francisco, author of several books on Photoshop and computer graphics. Ken, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Ken, over the past few weeks, I've been reading your new book, Digital Photography Expert Techniques, and it's been great. It's a wonderful guide, not just on like editing photos in Photoshop, but kind of the whole process of being a digital photographer. You start out with like what kind of gear you need and continue on. So today's show, I kind of want to talk with you a little bit about that process of looking at digital photography as an entire workflow, not just the discrete parts of like editing the file in Photoshop. So if you're game, we'll do that.
I'm more than game.
Great. The book by O'Reilly, Digital Photography Expert Techniques.
I'm sorry. You did say O'Reilly. I thought
yes.
You said Wiley.
No, O'Reilly. Yes.
Wanted to make sure we got the publisher right.
You talk about the equipment you need. So why don't you tell us all, what do you think the base equipment you need to go out and do a shoot is?
Well, of course, it depends on what your objective is in doing the shoot and what level you're working on as a digital photographer. Do you want me to break that down for you?
I would.
Well, I would say that for the person who's just starting out and wants to learn about digital photography, it's probably better to start with a camera that's affordable, learn your way around, and then be an educated person when you go to invest, significant money in one.
Mm-hmm.
So I would start with a 2 to 3 megapixel camera, which you can easily find many good versions of today for, between $150 and $300.
Right. And that, do you think that's the most important feature in looking at a digital camera is the megapixels?
It's not nearly as important as everybody would have you believe.
Okay.
it's one of the factors that you should certainly take into consideration, but you also want to read lots of reviews and find out what the noise level of the camera is,
mm-hmm.
How reliable it is. My feeling is you're almost always better off to stick with a name brand camera manufacturer.
What do you shoot with?
Pardon?
What kind of cameras what do you use? Canon, Nikon, what do you?
I use a Fuji S2.
Fuji S2. And how many megapixels is that?
That's debatable.
Okay. There is process.
It uses a sensor that's hexagonally shaped, and uh-huh. every row of sensors is offset 50% from the row above it or below it.
Okay.
Okay. So the pixels are staggered. The result is that you have the same resolution from corner to corner as you do from top to bottom or side to side.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you a much sharper, cleaner picture with a whole lot less noise interference than the traditional sensor does.
Mm-hmm.
But the drawback is that you have to interpolate that image by double in order to make good sense of it. So it's a 6 megapixel sensor in terms of the number of
pixels,
individual cells,
mm-hmm.
but it has to be interpolated to 12 megapixels. And my tests and everybody else whose tests I've read really rate it at someplace between 8 and 10 megapixels.
And
so
what's
it is
the camera
significantly
again?
Better than the normal 6 megapixel camera.
And what's the camera again?
It's a Fuji S2 Pro, which is built on a Nikon N80 body and takes all the Nikon autofocus lenses.
Very cool. All right, let's talk a little bit about other stuff you need besides a camera, because I thought that was a pretty impressive part of your book, actually, talking a little bit about you've got to have some other things to be an effective photographer. Let's say we're going
out. If you're going to be a professional photographer, you have to have something on sort of that level.
Yeah.
You have to have a digital SLR.
Right. Let's talk. What about a tripod? How important is a tripod in the workflow?
Well, it depends on the kind of photography you do, of course. But if you're going to do landscape and architecture, areas where it's traditional to have very high resolution, sharp edged photographs, then a tripod is pretty much a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're going to do any low light photography or nighttime photography.
Right. Let's talk a little about what kind of computer do you use? You use a Windows machine or a Mac?
I use a Windows machine. A lot of people are going to get upset about that, but that's too bad. I have owned both platforms for most of my 20-year career, 20 years in computers,
mm-hmm.
A lot longer than that in photography. Frankly, there is no significant difference in the way Photoshop runs on one platform or the other. The cost of the platform, however, is, you get a lot more for your money on a Windows platform. So
mm-hmm.
that's why I'm there. Performance really counts. And, if you're going for the fastest processor or dual processors and large hard drives and bigger monitors and that sort of thing, they can cost as much as 50% less if they're made for the Windows platform. So that's the reason I'm there, not because of any prejudice toward one platform or the other.
Now, do you consider Photoshop a crucial part of your photography?
I think that today it is photography. Or to put it another way, someone else asked me if I thought that traditional photography is dead, and I said, well, daguerreotypes are not dead.
What's a daguerreotype?
A daguerreotype was one of the very first means of making a photograph on a glass plate.
Right. It's not dead, but no one's doing it.
It's not dead, but only people who really want to do something in a very traditional and unusual way still use it. And that's a bit of an exaggeration where ordinary photography is concerned, but not for very long. And there actually have been scientific studies to compare digital photography with film, and as long as you have a digital SLR with 6 megapixels or more resolution, their finding is that digital photography is about 20% better than film.
Better in quality?
Better in quality, yeah. Now, there are a lot of considerations as to what quality amounts to, and it's not a strictly resolution thing.
Wait, but you say anything over... anything 6 or over is 20% better. Does that mean that 5 is exactly the same?
Well, that's a good discussion, and I'm glad you brought that question up, because actually, depending on how you make your print, 5 may be exactly the same as 6. And here's the reason why. Almost all of the 6-megapixel cameras use 35-millimeter film proportions, which is 2 to 3.
Mm-hmm.
And almost all of the 5-megapixel cameras use a 4-to-3 proportion. And if you make 8x10 prints or 16x20 prints, you're going to trim off that extra megapixel.
Oh, in the
to make the image fit the paper.
In the 6-megapixel, you mean?
Yeah. So you actually have a 5-megapixel image.
Hmm. But you have options to crop differently.
So you know that. For instance, Olympus is making a really excellent series of digital SLRs.
And SLR stands for?
Single lens reflex.
Okay, which means that
And what it really means is that the camera has interchangeable lenses.
All right.
And what it really means is that it's made for professionals and has no shutter lag and a sensor that's about 4 times as large as the 8-megapixel sensors that are in the prosumer cameras now.
And we're not talking about it's not four times 8 megapixels, it's 4 times the actual physical size is larger.
Exactly.
And what does that do for you in creating photographs?
What that means is that the individual sensors are further apart and larger.
Mm-hmm.
So there is far less noise between sensors. And actually, noise is a bigger contributor to or detractor from image quality than resolution is. And, you know, because it's hard to advertise and explain,
right.
most people don't understand that.
It's the same in the processor world. Everyone is looking for the highest speed processor, but when it comes down to it, there's a lot of other features that are making a machine work well than just its speed,
yeah, like
or just its megapixels.
Bus, you know, right. the processor can go like a bat out of you know where, but
right.
If the data doesn't move from the processor to the other parts of the computer quickly, it doesn't do you much good.
And when you speak of things like noise, are you speaking of low light and not having enough light, or
talking about the optics being bad?
That's
a major contributor to noise. So is, and it's a very close parallel to traditional film. The higher you rate the ISO of the sensor.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the ISO?
Digitally, you can just set that in the camera.
What does ISO stand for, traditionally in film?
International Standards Organization.
It's a rating of film.
American Standards Organization, and then too much of the world didn't want to buy our Kodak film, so they changed it.
Basically, it's a measurement of how sensitive the film is to light.
That's correct.
So digital cameras actually have sensitivity as well, and you can kind of set them at an equivalent ISO.
Yeah, and it's done so that people who are used to conventional photography will know where they stand,
right,
in terms of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of ways they could nominally rate the sensitivity of the sensor, but they might as well do it in the way everybody already knows. So
One thing that seems to be becoming much more important in digital photography is the management of your photos after you've taken them.
Yes,
so
it is.
So you go
let,
for a
let
weekend.
Let me say one more thing about ISO, though.
Please.
The higher the ISO goes, the more grain you have in film and the more noise you have digitally.
Isn't grain...
And it's almost a direct parallel.
Isn't grain kind of the same thing as noise?
It, kind of. Noise manifests itself as little blips of color that don't belong there. But it looks pretty much like grain. The end result is a look that looks pretty much like grain.
What does grain look like then?
Grain is just space between the
color changes.
Or? Yeah. Between the silver halide particles.
Right.
And they use bigger particles to get more sensitive film, so you can begin to see the particles as the ISO rating of the film goes up.
I see. And that's what the grain is the different. It's like pixelization almost.
And then the result is you get a softer picture that has a texture over whatever detail is in the picture, which is not real good if you're shooting the Grand Canyon.
But kind of neat if you're shooting a face.
Exactly. Well, especially in a nightclub.
Right. You right. Know, you get that kind of effect.
Or sports action that you have to stop at an 1/8000th of a second or something like that, you know.
So you get no blur from movement.
Right.
So that the thing about grain and film that's so different than noise and especially than pixelization of low resolution on digital is that it's not a regular pattern. It's kind of an organic crystallization pattern. So you don't see that effect of that of a screen being there or a pattern being there. You see
just
kind of
it's not quite as ugly.
Yeah, exactly. Are there Photoshop filters that allow you to kind of create that effect in digital photos?
Yes, there are. And there are also, and something that you're going to come to this in a minute, and I'll mention it in the kind of software that you should own, but something that everybody should have is a noise filtering software.
Well, which one do you use?
I use Nick Define.
Nick Define?
It's spelled D-F-I-N-E. That's a $99 program. There's also a free one on the market, and I wish I had the name of it with me. But it's pretty darn good, and you know, like I said, it's free, so there's no excuse for not using a noise filter at all. You know.
Right. Yeah, you can't beat that, and that's something that Photoshop doesn't do.
Professional for $99, there just isn't any contest.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. First, a little station break. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland, and we are speaking with digital photographer Ken Milburn via phone from San Francisco.
This week in This American Life, for David, prom night was the culmination of years of effort.
You know, I changed a lot since sophomore year. I got into this crowd and stuff, and they just changed my speech, my dress, and all that stuff. I'm still the same person. I just changed. This is a popular crowd. I'm just popular now. The most gorgeous girl in school, I asked for your prom. She says yes.
Prom night. Damn. Prom night this week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. If you want to call right now, you can. You can join our conversation about digital photography with our guest, Ken Milburn. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Unfortunately, sounds like we've lost Ken, though I want to continue our conversation, and hopefully he will call back. Well, while we're waiting for Ken to call back, we'll go ahead and take a call from Chris of Monterey. Chris, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, Lyle. This is Chris. And I had a question for Ken about a technology that I've been hearing about a couple of times over the last 2 years. I'm a photo professional, although I'm not a photographer. I do some work with digital, but I'm not as...
Darn, now we've lost her, but we do have Ken back. All right, sorry. Chris, please call us back. Ken, are you with us?
Yes.
Great, wonderful. We had a wonderful call coming in from Chris from Monterey, And unfortunately, we didn't get to her call. I cut her off while transferring you back on. Though she was calling about the Foveon chip, and she, I'm assuming, wanted to know a little bit more about it. Can you talk a little bit about the Foveon chip?
Not as much as I would like to be able to talk about the Foveon chip. If Sigma would send me a camera, I could talk about it much more intelligently.
But Sigma's not sending you a camera, huh?
Pardon?
Can you give us just a little rundown? Sigma's a chip manufacturer?
Well, digital cameras aren't that inexpensive that you can just run out and buy one for
right.
the luxury of being able to play with it. However, it's an extremely interesting technology. And what it does is one of the big problems with digital and that very few people understand, and a lot of people, and makes a lot of people think that digital is not as good as film, is the fact that there's something that most sensors use called a Bayer pattern. There's a pattern of colors that each sensor is filtered to be receptive to.
Right.
And there are two of those green sensors for every red and blue sensor. And then an algorithm has to go in and figure out how to reinterpret the picture so that all of those colors pertain to all of the pixels in the picture. It's a pretty complicated process. In that process, it slightly defocuses the picture, which is why it's very important to get rid of noise and to sharpen the image.
I see.
Follow me?
Yes.
Well, if you had a Foveon sensor, you could theoretically get rid of all that whole problem.
Because what's going on with the Foveon is that they actually, each pixel produce, collects every color.
Because they're...
stacked.
There are actually three sensors piled on top of one another, just like there are three layers of film.
Right.
And each layer is a different color, and they're transparent.
Well,
so
even if you haven't used the Foveon, I'm sure you've heard a lot of discussion about it.
Does it have
a good image quality? Is it impressive?
But, if I'm going to say something authoritative about something, I like to have had some experience with it.
Well, I do have some contact at Sigma, so maybe we should get you a camera. I'm assuming that's what the call was about, if she'd like to call back. If any of you would like to call back and join the conversation, ask Ken some questions about digital photography, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. No one's waiting. Because I've cut everyone off, so now's your chance to come on in and talk to us.
Well, I'll just keep on blabbing on.
Yeah, in that case, we'll keep going with the discussion. I did want to talk about the noise reduction software a little
bit
more.
One thing I'd like to say about the Foveon is that if you're considering investing in a professional camera, it's certainly worth your while to go test a Sigma.
Okay, in the Central Coast, how do you test a Sigma? Where do you go?
I'm not sure in your area
where do you
what
go
the
in
big
Texas
camera store is, but if there's a big professional camera store that's sort of on the same level as Gasser is in San Francisco or Calumet,
the closest
that's,
one,
that's the place to go.
The closest one in the Monterey Bay, I think, is Keeble and Shuckett in Palo Alto.
Right. That's the one I keep hearing about the most.
It's a great place. I actually went there last Saturday and picked up a Nikon D70, which is a pretty nice SLR camera.
It's a very nice SLR camera.
I'm extremely happy with it. The only problem I'm having is that...
Especially for the money.
Yeah, it's
the only problem you have is your bank account is empty.
there's that problem, but I'm selling something to count for that. But the problem I'm having from a managing photo issue is that within less than a week, I've taken 2 gigs of photos, and that's something like 800 and something photos. What do I do with all these photos?
Oh, I have a wonderful answer for that.
Delete them? No.
Well, that is an important thing to do.
It's 100% compression.
That is probably the first thing you should do in Photoshop is go through the file browser and just look for everything you know you're never going to use and get the delete button. It instantly disappears and saves you a lot of hard drive space.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't cost you anything to throw those things away. In fact, it saves you money because you don't have to buy as many hard drives. You know?
Right. So you do then, when you do go out and do a shoot, you will throw away a lot of
things.
The
real question that I think that you're answering that's important is when you go out someplace on location, you can only afford so many flashcards for your camera.
Right.
And chances are you're going to fall in love with wherever you are and take so many pictures that you run out of space on your flashcards, you know, long before you run out of time to take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been battling that myself for a while because I really didn't want to go out and spend $500 or $600 on a pocket drive.
Mm-hmm.
I just found one that works better than any pocket drive I've ever used, and it cost me $100.
What is it?
It's made by IO Magic, and its actual list price is closer to $200. But if you shop around, its drawback is that it's a USB 1.1 device. Which means that transferring the files is slow.
What is a pocket drive? This is a pocket drive. What is
a pocket drive is a self-powered drive that you can carry around in your pocket. You don't need to run off to a coffee shop and plug it under the wall to make it work.
And you don't need a computer.
And you don't need a computer.
So you take your camera card out and you stick it into this device and push
That's
a button
right.
and it
and
unloads
the problem
it.
With a lot of them is that they do so many other things. They play MP3 files. They have a large LCD monitor so you can run slideshows for your friends, and, you know, you can do all these fancy things, and then they break.
How big is the one that you got?
The lovely thing about this little IO Magic thing is you stick your card in, you push a button, and these little lights blink for about 15 minutes, and when they turn off, it turns off the drive to save you battery time, and you take the card out, and all the files have been copied.
Are you sure all the files
pretty
have been copied?
A no-brainer.
Are you sure that all the files have been copied? That's the only concern I'd have, is I'd be scared.
Well, I've been using it for a while, and the files have always all been copied. So
it's the IO Magic drive or something from them.
IO.
How big is the one that you got?
Magic. Pardon?
How big is the one you got? How many gigs?
20.
20 gigs. And you find that that's enough?
Which is plenty.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you really have to be on an intense sports shoot or something like that to use up more than that in one day before you're going to be able to get back to your laptop. And, you know.
Right.
In fact, most laptops don't even have drives that are too much larger than 20 gigabytes.
No, they're getting there.
And they have other things on them. You know.
We had a caller wants to know off air, so I mean we're not going to hear the beautiful voice of our caller, unfortunately, about color management for digital photos and Mac and PC. Can you talk a little about color management?
Boy, that's such a big topic. I hardly know where to start.
Do you recommend any books on this subject?
The most important thing is that you get a sensor for your so that you can calibrate your monitor accurately. You know, regardless of all the other considerations, if what you see on your monitor isn't representative of what the real quality of the image is, then you're never going to get any place with the rest of the formula.
You know, I think color management is such a big topic, as you mentioned, and I do know an expert on the subject up at UCSC, that I think we'll do a show in a couple of weeks on that subject.
I think that's a very good idea.
Because it really is. But basically what you're talking about is you get this calibrator, and it's kind of like a little, like the size of a mouse, and it has a little sensor on it.
That's
and you
correct.
Stick that on your monitor. And it reads the input that it then puts color on the monitor, and it reads it and goes, oh, I know what colors this should be, and it then makes a profile for your monitor to adjust
that
to the right
correct.
Colors.
And it then adjusts the monitor.
And it's invaluable, really, when it comes to
monitoring.
Totally
invaluable. Yeah. And costs about $200, and probably the best $200 you'll ever spend.
Now, when you go from
once you've done that, and you have something like a good Epson printer, that you know, the chances are pretty excellent that the profile for your printer is going to be pretty accurate. So you're already miles ahead. You may not be perfect, and it may take a little more practice to get it absolutely right. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, because nothing is etched in stone, and you will have to do some practicing and some testing and eventually create your own profile.
When you print, when you want to do a print of some photography you've done, some professional photography, how do you do it?
Excuse me?
How do you do a print of photography, of your photography? What do you print on?
I print on, actually, I own several Epson printers. It really depends on size and how much money I have at the moment, because the technology moves ahead very rapidly. But if I had my druthers right now, I would own an Epson 2200 and either a 7600 or a 9600.
What about...
And that's because of the durability of the inks and the accuracy and the resolution and the speed and so forth, you know.
What about going to a photo bureau, someplace that does printing?
Actually, one of my favorite places to go that does printing is Costco.
Really?
They have a Fuji printer that the largest size is 12 by 18 inches, and they charge you all of $3 for that print.
12 by 18?
Yes, and it's made on Fuji Crystal Archive, which is one of the largest, longest-lasting, is what I was trying to say, one of the longest-lasting materials on the market. It looks totally photographic. There's no grain or dots or anything visible at all.
And how do you do it?
You can actually go to the Costco site and download the profile for their printer, and they come out just perfectly.
How do you turn in your photos to them? A CD?
You take them. Well, you can turn them in a bunch of different ways. You could take the cards from your camera if you're a snap shooter, you know. But what most professionals, and it's interesting, every time I go to Costco, there's about six professionals standing there having their prints made. So I've discovered it's an excellent networking opportunity, especially people who do a lot of models, composites, and that sort of thing, where they have a volume of prints to make.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in the local Santa Cruz area, a great company is Bay Photo. They'll do the same type of thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the rates exactly. We do have...
I've never seen rates quite that low.
No, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
We have Lee. Welcome, Lee, to GeekSpeak. Lee, are you with us?
Yes.
Yes. You're calling long distance, I hear.
Yes.
What's the question?
The question... I've got several. The first question is, how does Ken suggest that you, especially on Windows, because on the Mac you have color sync, but on Windows, what is the best way to make the RGB to CMYK conversion?
Ken, did you hear that?
The best way to make the RGB to CMYK conversion is essentially the same. Windows has a system that in the latest versions of Windows is pretty equivalent to color sync. But the main thing about making the RGB to CMYK conversion is to make it the very last thing that you do before you send that image to wherever it's going to be finally output to a CMYK device.
Ken, do you use Photoshop to do that CMYK conversion?
Yes.
Okay, so why does it matter what platform you're on when you do
Doesn't.
That? Okay.
Okay, well then...
But there are a lot of people who will tell you that it does, because it's only been fairly recently that Windows has had anything that was really equivalent to color sync in terms of accuracy, profile accuracy. And that's the reason why a lot of prepress people will tell you to do it on a Mac.
Lee? You
should not do it on older versions of Windows.
Lee, do you have a further question?
Yes. Okay, if you've got a nice setup in your studio where your monitor's looking okay because you've calibrated it, and perhaps you're using Epson profiles, or let's just assume that you're using canned Epson profiles or something like that for your local CMYK printing device, or possibly even a six-color Epson printing device.
Mm-hmm.
And you've shown these prints to your clients, and your clients say, "That's great," especially from the canned CMYK profile. And then you want to take it to the offset press, and you need to basically match the print. And do you understand my question, Ken?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could elaborate?
Well, it's a very confusing issue, because there's really no relationship between the profile for your Epson printer and your CMYK profile.
That's the canned profile.
But the only way that you're going to do that really accurately is either by purchasing a profile. Well, actually, a lot of pre-press places will give you their profile.
Okay, well,
and so,
supposing,
you know,
that we
you,
could make,
you
the,
make the most accurate image that you can in RGB and convert it to CMYK and then convert to that profile, and you should get a pretty accurate result. But, you know, you always have to say those things with some reservation and trepidation, because the reality is that the best answer is always, in creating a color chart of your own, and continuing to make prints until you know you've got it nailed for your particular computer, you know, your particular devices and so on and so forth.
Ken, could you suggest a low-cost way to calibrate a local printer and generate your own profiles, and then could you elaborate that into a workflow to work with a local printer?
I wish I wasn't having to make this call away from my office, because then I could give you a very good suggestion by name. But Color Vision makes a little device that's a scanner, and they will provide you with a test chart. And what you do is you do the usual thing to set up the profile for your printer, and or, you know, the usual test. And then print that out and run their chart through their scanner, and it reads that the scan of that chart and then makes the adjustments that it needs to exactly create a profile for the printer. And you can do that all in a matter of minutes.
Lee, thank you for the call. We've got some people waiting. We're going to go to the next person.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael from San Miguel, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, yeah, I have a question. As far as archival, when you print out, is there any printer that you can use that will actually last more than, I don't know, 10 years or something?
I didn't hear the last, but it will actually last more than...
10 years.
10 years.
Because, well, I have some that are on the refrigerator. Been on there maybe 3 years, and they're just fading out. And I use the Epson, what, 1270. Does that at all make sense?
Well, the answer to that is that nothing will really stand this treatment.
Nothing will stand what treatment?
Well, a lot of UV, for one thing, mm-hmm. and or a lot of oxidation.
So what do you use in printing on your Epson printers to make sure that the photograph lasts as long as possible?
I use DuraBright inks or Lysine inks, and try pretty much to stick with their papers or with companies whose papers have been tested by other people, and, you know, pretty much proven to be.
Do you ever spray a UV enhancer?
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that you do need to put prints under glass and hang them in an area that's not going to be in direct sunlight for extended periods of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like everything you've ever seen, they will fade.
So that's the trick, is to put them under glass and put them in dark spaces or non-sunlight
spaces.
Well, not
dark, but, you know, not direct sunlight.
Right.
Not
direct light.
What about UV sprays?
I don't like them.
Why not?
It takes a lot of practice to get it to be really smooth.
Mm-hmm.
The theory is really good, and Kodak is making a paper that's very interesting. I don't know that anybody's really tested it carefully enough to prove that it meets its claims, but it's called Ultima,
mm-hmm.
and I did make a print that was primarily blue and black, because those are the colors that fade the fastest, and deliberately taped it outside my window on the sunny side of the street,
mm-hmm.
and... usually a print that you treat that badly will last for maybe a couple of weeks. This one has been still taped to my window for almost 2 months, and it's still blue, and the black is absolutely black.
Wow.
And Kodak's claim is that what's happening is that they have several layers of gelatin on the paper, so that the ink keeps getting absorbed to a lower and lower layer of gelatin, so where it finally rests is so far away from the elements and so well protected from UV that, you know, basically nothing can touch it.
Great.
They claim a 200-year lifespan.
And what's the paper again?
It's called Ultima.
Ultima.
U-L-T-I-M-A.
By Kodak.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Michael, for the call.
And it only comes in glossy, and it only comes in sizes 8x10 or smaller, so it's too new to solve everybody's problems yet,
right.
But it's very interesting new technology.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Our guest via phone is author and photographer Ken Milburn. We are taking calls about digital photography. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Amy from Capitola, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, no problem.
Okay. I was wondering, you alluded to a product earlier. You said it was the best $200 you could spend for calibration of your monitor. Could you, do you have the brand name for that?
It's made by ColorSync.
By ColorSync?
Yeah.
And what's it called?
And it's also distributed through Pantone.
Okay.
So you shouldn't have much trouble at all finding it.
Uh-huh. And it's just a color calibrator for your monitor.
That's correct.
Okay. And it's
and all the software you need and the test charts and so on.
So if I went to the Pantone website, I'd be able to find it?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You
great
bet.
Show today.
Thank you for the call.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Actually, on GeekSpeak, we're planning next week to also do some more digital photography. And the following week, it looks like color management. And we are speaking right now with Ken Melbourne, photographer and digital photographer, I should say. And we have David from Watsonville. David, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi, Lyle.
Hi.
So I just caught your program on the way into work and got a question. I didn't catch the full conversation, so I hope I'm not off topic. But got a question regarding camera's abilities to have digital zoom. And my real question is, what is the point of digital zoom on a digital camera?
Ken, can you address that?
That's a very good question. And it's a very simple answer. There is no point.
Yeah, I figure you can just do that with software.
I'm being overly harsh. There is a point if you have a small camera and need to make pictures on somebody else's device where you don't have any control over cropping.
Uh-huh.
Other than that, it's the worst thing you can do. You can do a much better job of cropping and resampling the image to make the best quality crop if you use your much more powerful computer to do it with,
right.
and something like Photoshop.
I notice it's such a big selling point with a lot of the manufacturers, digital zoom, you know.
Yeah, it's just marketing, you know what.
Yeah, okay. that's what I've kind of felt it already. You just kind of,
it's
not that
total baloney.
Yeah, okay. So I have a pet peeve to share with you.
Go ahead.
I noticed that a lot of people, when they get their digital cameras, they just leave the size setting at this grotesquely large size, and then when they put their photos up on the web, it's just way too large. And I think that people just really need to control the picture size on their digital cameras.
Well, or the what they display online.
Right.
I mean, you want a large file size on your camera. If
they really shouldn't control it in their digital cameras, because if they do, they'll never be able to get a higher resolution picture.
Oh, okay, yeah, good point.
That they'll never be able to photograph again.
But they need to change it on their web pages, I suppose.
Resample that image to a smaller size for use, but to a much smaller size for use on the web.
David, thank you for the call.
All right, thanks, Lyle.
Ken, is there anything else you wanted to cover quickly?
Well, that all depends.
I know we have a lot more subject to talk about, but unfortunately we're running out of time on GeekSpeak. So I just want to give you an opportunity to mention something you think is an important feature of Photoshop or of a... this is a good one. What's the most important thing on a digital camera to know about your own camera? What's the most important thing to be aware of?
Well, can I put that another way?
Please do.
you had asked me earlier... What the best thing to do with your digital camera was in order to be prepared.
Yes.
And I think that's a really important tip to give to people. And that is, set the ISO rating at ISO 200.
Okay.
Which is low enough not to create a lot of noise and high enough to get you through some fairly low light situations and not too much blurring.
Mm-hmm.
And put the camera in point-and-shoot mode and on matrix metering, if you've got matrix metering.
Okay.
That will give you the best chance of getting the shot when you don't have time to think about it.
Great.
And that's something you should do every time you get through with shooting in some other mode for some specific purpose. You know, because things always happen that we always wish we had a picture of.
Ken Milburn is a digital photographer in San Francisco and author of several books on Photoshop and computer graphics. His new book is titled Digital Photography, Expert Techniques by O'Reilly. You can learn more about Ken by going to kenmilburn.com. Ken, thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. The geeks today were Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating on GeekSpeak. To those of you that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us blabbing, and who really wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KDBH San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. And one more thank you I want to mention. In March of this year, our community lost my father, Peter Troxell. In April, KUSP ran its regular spring pledge drive. My family and I heard hundreds of people calling in to support the station. So many of you pledged in memory of my father, and thank you. Your support helped us during a very difficult time. My dad believed very strongly in supporting both art and community. He loved KUSP. He loved helping people connect with each other. Strengthening community was his life's work. Thank you for your pledges and for supporting KUSP, our community radio station. And Dad, happy birthday. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.